Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 327, for Friday, December 29th, 2017. The year's best interviews. Triangulation is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who've hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences this year alone. For more, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Welcome to Triangulation, everybody. Of course, a special episode. Here we are at the end of the year. We thought it'd be fun to put together some of the best moments, and there have been a great many. This is a show that's full of great moments from the year of Triangulation. We'll start off with a great conversation I had with the founder of Napster, a guy who was a hacker in his early days, Jordan Ritter, and what he learned as a Napster founder and running his own startup now about the importance of having a great team. I agree. You were at the time still probably at Napster, I would guess.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I remember what a thing Napster was. I still probably have, I don't know, 30 or 40 gigabytes of music that I downloaded from Napster at the time.
I never downloaded anything or did anything illegal.
Never did anything illegal. Of course not. And nor did I, because I then bought all those songs later or something.
Truth was, I would have paid.
That was the problem. Yeah, there wasn't a way to do it that was legal. So
I pay now.
In the defense of Napster, I don't think I'm alone. It brought me back to music.
Yes.
I was able to find songs I couldn't find any other way, a record store or any other way, that I remembered and knew songs. And since then, I've paid more, bought more music than ever before, thanks to Napster. And I think that's really often
a discovery tool.
It's a discovery tool.
Yeah.
And I think it's often the case that the movie industry got all upset about VCRs until they made billions on video rentals. The music industry probably underestimated the value of Napster. Their business was going to change anyway. They just didn't want to go. They went kicking and screaming.
Well, it's like every revolution. Every single revolution. What happens at the end?
Right.
They march the rebel leaders up against a wall.
Right.
They shoot them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the equivalent of Apple comes in.
Right.
And builds an actual business.
Right.
It's
a real
it.
Business. Yeah, suddenly, wow, amazing. iTunes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after, did you stay, how long did you stay with Napster? Did you stay through the end?
No. The question is, when did the end start and when did the end actually end? Because there were several times we got stomped by the federal government. So I stayed through the first two stompings and then I left. It was
stop me once, shame on you. Stop me twice, shame on me.
Yeah, it was a miserable experience. That part of to have built and ridden along with something so great and something so impactful, and then have to turn it off, and then have to turn it back on, and then have to turn it off again. And for me, I think that combined with the increasing gap between management's understanding of what made the organization tick and what it actually was that made it operate,
yeah,
is just too much for me. And it was time for me to move on. So I stayed like first year and 6 months, year and change.
Yeah,
the formative years.
But boy,
but it went on.
Time.
It kept going.
Oh yeah,
on.
It's still around.
I resigned.
The name exists.
The day Bertelsmann made their $60 million investment.
Really?
That was the day.
That was the day. That was when it was over. I mean, Bertelsmann, one of the big three record.
Well, so some people have strong Napster experiences who started after
at
that point.
Right.
And who am I to invalidate that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
But the culture. This is
yes.
And in a way, this was kind of, I think, the end of this magical time in general. Do you think?
It had ended maybe a little sooner.
When the big companies come in, the big money comes in.
I'm not anti-big money and I'm not anti-big companies, but I am anti-jerks and I am anti-idiots.
Okay.
And I think it was the descending of those types that didn't understand, that could not fully understand what would make that business successful. Just objectively, we hired a lawyer as a CEO, and lawyers are not known as risk-taking people. Yeah. And if you're in a startup, we know now, if you're trying to break new ground, you have to naturally be a risk taker. Right. A thoughtful risk taker, but a risk taker. Yeah. And so there are just these easy sort of things you can look back in hindsight and go, that was not a good choice. That was not a good choice. Yeah. That was missing.
But that's how you learn.
That's how new neural pathways get built. Yep.
And so you took lessons from this and you went on to found more companies.
Yep.
What do you think are the important lessons that you took?
Well, one of the most important ones to this day is the importance of culture and the importance of value. So I have I've built up a bunch of aphorisms over the years, but the one that applies here is the most important asset you build in any startup is not the product, it's not the business, it's not the technology, it's not the opportunity, it's the group, it's the team. They are the most important asset. A great team, not a good team, but a great team can take a mediocre idea and turn it into something.
Interesting.
But a average team, a dysfunctional team, will take the next Facebook and F it up 100% of the time.
Wow.
100% of the time. It's always about the people. And there is no schema, there's no process, there's no org structure that defines great people. It's the people that define a great people, and you build that process around them. So the focus has to be in the early stages. Of course, you're trying to build a business. Of course, you have goals and objectives that you have to pursue towards, but it's the great team that will get you there. And so that really, you know, looking back on what made WooWoo successful, what made Napster a really, why we were able to do what we were able to do in the face of so much, or what made CloudMark successful, especially in the first 5 years, what made all my subsequent companies, including now Atlas, in this last year, so much radical stuff has been done. And it's just amazing. It all comes from this careful, thoughtful attention. You know, at first, which was accidental, we accidentally were a great WooWoo group.
And right.
We were a slightly more intentionally great group at CloudMark and so on. Totally accidental at Napster. But having learned from all that and going, oh, okay, you know, this is, why is it the most important asset? It's the great team that's going to figure the crazy stuff out. You will never get it right the first time, what the business should be, what the product should be, what the right features will be. And it's the great team that will evolve through those the most effectively and most efficiently. And why do we have a late stage, you know, a revenue stage innovation problem in all of technology industry? It's because the priorities change.
Right. It
used to be risky innovation hunting around in the dark.
Yep.
Now it's stability and scale, kind of the antithesis of those things. And that original team that created that business disintegrates.
You can see that over and over.
You lose them 100% of the time.
How do you build a great team, though?
Ah. So, I keep getting encouraged to...
you're going
to
write that book.
Write it down.
Yep.
We've been writing blog posts and syndicating some stuff around that. But I think it starts with... all culture flows from the top. It doesn't matter what's written on a wall. It doesn't matter what's in the manual. It doesn't matter what the co-founder standing next to the CEO thinks. It doesn't matter what the culture committee thinks. It's the true values that the leader abides by are the ones that the organization will follow. Being distinct and honest about what those values are. So, you know, there are multiple combinations of values that work in the world and in our societal norms. Like, there isn't just one set of what a good person is. There are many dimensions to that, and all of those aren't necessary to build a great kernel of a culture. But being deliberate about what they are, and then being deliberate about hiring for them. So I think 99.
Give me an example. What are you hiring for?
Well, you look at our values: adaptability, craftsmanship, obsession. I once had passion as a value in a prior company, and passion is impossible to measure.
But obsession is good.
Obsession is wonderful.
Yeah.
Was Bill Gates passionate or obsessive?
Right.
Was Steve Jobs passionate or obsessive? Larry Ellison? Like, it's obsession that is the rocket fuel.
That's a better word, isn't it?
Yeah. Values like that, bias towards action, you know, these are things that, first of all, as words that we choose to define culture, are very important to be specific about which words, how you pick those words. So here's how I think about culture. So here's how we do it at Atlas. Culture is made up of three core parts. The first is values, something very specific. They're words that can be used to evaluate, assess, praise, and critique. If you pick a word that you can't use to evaluate, assess, praise, and critique, in our definition, it's not a good word, is a value.
Okay.
Right, so that's why passion, I don't think, is a great value. Yeah. You can say you value it as a verb, but it is not a value.
Yeah.
right? Different.
You can't measure it. You can't measure it, right?
You can't say good job or bad job without destroying somebody over it or it having some meaning, then it's not a good value. So we have values. That's one third of it. We have what we call ethos. These are these aphorismic phrases that also define our culture, but they're not evaluation, assessment, praise, and critique words. They're phrases like sooner is better, now is best. Phrases like clean hands make you wrong.
What does that mean?
Get them dirty. If you don't know, if you're a white hat, if you're a real white hat and you don't know what you're talking
about,
you're wrong. Exactly. And so we have those phrases that, that represent our ethos.
Yeah.
And they're great things to remind us, inspire us, but we're not measuring against them necessarily. And then the third thing, the third bucket is traits. So sometimes you'll see someone put in self-reliance as a value. But how do you really measure that? And that isn't an ethos statement, but it is something that you look for in people.
Right.
It's an attribute of what you think it means to be successful within our company. So collectively, that is our DNA. The Atlas DNA is that's how, after having done it so many times, that's the latest schema that we use. And how we arrive at the values is actually going to be the subject of a really lengthy blog post, because I've done it a bunch of times. We did a mid-flight values process at Cloudmark. So we were already a company of 50 or some odd people with like 7 executives. And then we did the values exercise. And I think the lesson there was we had already fractured as a culture.
Right.
And
you had to do it.
We had to do it, but what it elucidated was we already had more than one culture.
Yeah.
It was too late.
Interesting.
It was helpful as an exercise, but it was too late to really define it to make sure that it could endure.
Yeah, yeah.
There were too many different perspectives.
You have to do it early. Do it at the beginning.
You have to, well, if you're good at it, if you have that, you can define it at the beginning, and it's a thing that gets revisited. So we recently revisited ours after 3 years.
Right.
Because everything we do, and another piece of advice is process and structure and schema is there to serve us. We are not there to serve it. It is the thing that adapts and changes to us. And so societies change, norms change, cultures change, everything changes, and you have to build in these intervals to reassess and evolve and grow and adapt things that you've defined early on. But yes, the truth is when you go hire people, you are actually going to hire for values. You might not be deliberate about it, but there's something in your gut that's going to go, yep, this feels right, or something doesn't feel right. And implicit in there is sort of this assessment of, does this person believe in what I believe in? That's where what the difference is between good teams and great teams is shared values, shared mindset, shared ethos, shared attributes. That is fundamentally the difference. And so one of the things I like to talk about a lot is the way we do recruiting 99% of the time is completely broken. It's completely broken, right? We break it up into three categories: culture, capacity, and craft. It's the three C's. Culture, all the things I just talked about. Capacity for mastery is about your ability. Google sometimes calls it velocity of learning, but it's this notion that in a startup you're only ever doing new things. If you're doing a good one, like you're only walking into undiscovered country. So your ability to adapt and ingress something mm-hmm. new and master it is much more important than the skills or the craft that you bring to the table.
Right.
It's important, but it's third. With the first two, you can get the third.
Yes.
But 99% of interviewing is all about the third.
Yes.
We have a job description and need, want, nice to have. Then we compute. Yes, yes, no, yes, no, yes, yes. 80%, great, let's hire this person. And that has nothing to do with building a great team whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the
don't
way
hire for skills, hire for the ability.
Culture and capacity.
Yeah, capacity.
Yeah, that's what we call it. But there's, and I learned that in Cloudmark.
Yeah.
I learned the capacity for mastery thing at Cloudmark. There was this one guy who's a phenomenal guy. I'm not going to embarrass him, but he's awesome. And we had just finished a very clever one-hour interview. I have this circular linked list question that I ask in four different ways and, you know, teaches me a lot of how you think. But I was, you know, he was like, he was okay. He's an average guy. By the end of the interview, I was unimpressed. And we had like 10 minutes left. And so I just was like, okay, so what else do you do in your spare time? And then he stopped. The whole room changed. He's like, let me tell you about brewing beer. And then he launched into the thing that he'd built in his garage. Yeah. And then he's launched into, and I like this kind and this kind. If you use this kind of hops, but you let it sit for this long instead of this long, what they usually tell you is to do it this way. But I've learned if you do it this way, you get a whole different flavor. And if you bottle it and you let it sit in the sun for, you know, an extra day before you do this, like this was an engineering mindset. He may not have been the greatest engineer, but he had such a strong capacity to master the details of things. That was that thing in play.
Isn't that great? You saw that capacity.
Yes.
Didn't matter what the skill set was at that point.
He will figure it out.
He'll figure it out.
Because he has it. And it was a profound moment for me. And that's something we folded into our culture.
I think it's really interesting that you have really codified this and spent a lot of time thinking about this. God, I hope you write that book. Well, let's go back a little bit in time. So you were a practicing attorney. How did you get to Tech TV?
Let's see if I can remember that far back. So I was an attorney in Manhattan back in 1995. And you know, I partnered with someone from law school, Luke Ryder, who's working actively and successfully in Los Angeles. And he and I pitched this novel idea that there would be high-tech crime on the internet and using technology. And so we pitched a show called Cybercrime. Oh, my gosh. Look at that.
Here it is.
So that's – oh, wow. Look at that. Look how dark my hair is,
But the rest of you is exactly the same. The love bug worm. It's funny because it feels like such a naive time. This was what, 1999, 98?
Yes, 1999. That's right.
And
2000.
It feels like that. This one is from May 2000, but it wasn't the first one. It feels like such a naive time compared to today, where cybercrime is you know, rampant, as a much bigger story than it was. But I guess there was plenty to talk about even in 1999 and 2000.
We did. We could fill a show. We did 100 episodes, a half hour every single week, and we were there were just heaps of different stories that we could track down, and a lot of it was early days, as you pointed out, but ultimately a lot of the big concerns about cyber terrorism and some of these other kind of very important topics right now were at at the kernel in our initial stage.
Yeah.
So we were lucky to have identified that trend early on. We were able to secure cybercrime.com, which was amazing when I was able to register it back in 1997. And it's turned out to be obviously central to even what I do today when we talk about the news.
Yeah, it couldn't be more central. I mean, what a great background. And we still spend a lot of time talking about cybercrime. Almost every day we're talking about a new cybercrime. What happened to Luke?
Luke's doing well in Los Angeles. He's worked on The Blacklist, and he's worked on probably a dozen other shows where he's either an executive producer or basically running the shows.
Wow.
So he's done so well for himself.
Wow, The Blacklist is awesome.
I know, it is awesome.
So he went into fiction, and you stayed with nonfiction.
That's right. That's exactly it. And for a while, I was right there trying to decide at that crossroads whether I wanted to go down to Los Angeles or stay in news. And I got this great opportunity to work with CNN, and it was clear to me that that was the path. And I'm really glad that I went down that nonfiction path.
Yeah. Yeah, although I remember, were you not writing a novel? I feel like you were writing a novel, or maybe it was just scripts at the time.
You have an excellent memory. I did write a few scripts, and I did write a novel that was published as well as a nonfiction book. So the first book I wrote was nonfiction, Barman.
That was a great book. I forgot about you. Your story as a law student. I loved Barman.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then I wrote a book about, well, inspired by my wife, Chris, called Lovesick, which was fiction.
Oh,
that's right. Thank you.
You were lovesick. Oh.
Well, parts of it were true. I mean, there was a crime ring of senior citizens, so that part didn't actually happen.
Now I got to go look it up. Lovesick, a novel.
That's right.
It was Love at First Sight. Halloween, 1983. She was Princess Leia. He was Chewbacca. Determined to be more than star-crossed lovers, Andy vowed to do whatever it took to make Paige Day his bride, even if that meant dragging himself back to the small town of Crockett, California, and working for her father, Gregory, the local pharmacist.
The literary genius. Yes. Thank you.
Well, it's still in print.
Yes, it is. It's still available out there. I'll sign any autograph if somebody sends it to me.
That's great. But you decided news was more interest. The thing you were doing at Tech TV, cybercrime, was of more interest to you. So you did 100 episodes. You didn't go down with the ship as I did.
You have been so successful. Why? You're always so self-effacing. Maybe that's why you've been
I wrote it into the ground, and then they bought it. The bad guys bought it and took it to Los Angeles, and they said, thanks, Leo, but we'll see you later.
Did you just see that Esquire TV? They're winding down, I think. So
another failure.
That's right. So because it was Tech TV. No, it was ZDTV, Tech TV, G4, and then
G4 Tech TV briefly, then G4. Then G4 folded and became Esquire TV, partnered with Esquire. Was that them? No, I don't know. You know, they talked about it, and I think they ended up not doing it.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they lost they lost the deal, believe it or not. You know how that happens. Hollywood.
Well, yes, very much so. But yeah, I was always interested in the news side of things, and I got an appetite for it while working on cybercrime, and had a lot of contacts in that space. And then ultimately when I came to CNN, I was focusing on technology and the role that technology was playing in the news. But then I ultimately shifted in 2007 ahead of the 2008 election to work in the political unit. And I was kind of...
Oh, what fun.
The integration czar between TV and digital at that time. And that changed probably the course of my career.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that, because that was always something we struggled with at ZDTV and Tech TV. And even before that, with the show we did for MSNBC called The Site, it was practically a war between the digital side and the television side. Not a lot of love lost, a lot of struggling. It was a difficult thing to do then, and probably still a difficult thing to do. And yet, it's imperative, obviously, that all news media has to look at the digital side.
Today's guest is Brad Stone, author of The Upstarts. He is also author of The Everything Store and executive editor for technology at Bloomberg News. And I'm so excited that he's here to talk to us. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you for having me.
So I like to read fiction. I have a degree in creative writing, and that's what I like to do when I've, you know, put away the computer at night. But this book really captured me. It was a page turner, which is interesting because it's a story that that, you know, as technology journalists, we're very familiar with. But just knowing the backstory and the way that that you told it, I just loved it. So let's start with just the beginning. This book is about the upstarts. It's about Uber, Airbnb, some other companies, some of their competitors. And you start it in 2008, which was the Obama inauguration, which the founders of Uber and Airbnb were both there. Just tell a little bit about why you started the story there.
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to say those are the largest post-it notes in your book I've ever seen.
But it's so great. I know. It's like I grab whatever is
handy. You know, they make them a little smaller.
This is actually leftover Valentine pink construction paper, which was what I had handy when I was reading this. So
it's good to know you're recycling. And thank you for the kind words about the book. You know, one of the things I was worried about when I started out with this idea of matching together the stories of ride sharing and home sharing, Airbnb with journeys of Uber, Lyft, Didi, and other ride sharing companies around the world, I was sort of worried that it would be two books. That it would feel like I really wanted to interweave the stories, and I didn't want it to feel like folks were kind of bouncing back and forth. But one of the things that I discovered when I was doing the reporting was that there were so many areas of intersection between the stories. I mean, not only are Brian Chesky of Airbnb and Travis Kalanick of Uber friends, and they learn from each other and they watch each other, and I'm sure to some extent they are jealous of each other, but the stories really naturally intersected. And one of the surprising areas of intersection was at the very beginning, at the Obama inauguration in January 2009, when the founders of a very little known website called airbedandbreakfast.com were handing out flyers and kicking around the DC mall anonymously that day. And the founders of a yet to be started company called UberCab were also there in DC, staying at a VRBO and basically kind of going to the parties and thinking about what it would be like if you could actually get a car during a very busy moment like the inauguration of a new president in a city that was overwhelmed with people. And so in a way, it was just totally organic. Both of these stories start at the very same place. And then jumping ahead, the book ends with the inauguration of a new president. And it was significant to me that everything happened in the span of one presidential administration. You know, two companies valued at a cumulative $100 billion or more changed the way cities operate, left plenty of chaos and controversy in their wake. So that was, I knew I couldn't tell the comprehensive story of these companies because they're young and their stories are still unfolding, but I wanted to capture a moment of time.
So it must have been exciting being a Star Wars fan coming out of college to go work for LucasArts.
Yeah, you know, when LucasArts called, because they called me, I didn't apply for the job. They had called me because they were looking for a Commodore 64 programmer, and I had been recommended by somebody. And when they called looking for a programmer, I had no idea that Lucasfilm made games at all. You know, I didn't know that they had a games group or any of that
stuff.
You
weren't alone.
So I was really, really surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was a great, right? I mean, it's like the dream job in some ways.
What was your first game? You were doing ports for the Atari 800, which means I was an Atari 800 fanatic, so that means I played a few of your games. What games did you port?
I ported Cronus Rift. Oh, that was the first game that I did.
Fun.
And then I also ported Ball Blazer from the Atari to
Ball
the
Blazer was great. So you went the other way around, the other direction. Or no, you went from the Commodore to the 800?
No, I went from the Atari to the Commodore. I was porting from the Atari to the Commodore.
Oh, interesting. You were right. Of course, that's why they wanted a Commodore kid.
Yeah.
I get it. You're taking
the games. Yeah, because they had nobody on staff that did Commodore 64 programming.
There was a big difference, as I remember. The Atari had a lot of hardware support for sprites and for music and stuff. Was it hard to do those ports?
It wasn't particularly hard. I mean, they were both 6502 machines, right, which was a huge advantage because most of the code worked. But the graphics were quite different. I don't know that one had better graphics than the other, but they were just quite different. You know, the Atari had these, you know, very, I think they were very tall sprites that you could do, where the Commodore, you know, had basically square sprites and
things like that.
It was a little bit different. And the Commodore, you know, did character set graphics really well, and the Atari didn't. And, but I shared an office, with the guy who was doing the Atari port. And so we worked very, very closely together to do that.
Yeah. Did you write tools to do it, or did you do it all by hand?
We had an assembler, Chip Morningstar, who worked at Lucasfilm. He had written a custom assembler for 6502, and so we had that assembler. And then I think they'd written a graphics program that did the graphics and the art and stuff for it.
Cool. Well, so what was your first original game that you worked on?
That was Maniac Mansion.
All right. You said the words. Now I have to play.
I started up.
This is actually a YouTube full playthrough. We could turn off the guy's. I'll turn off the guy's narration. But this was state of the art graphics adventure back in the day, and this was a horror title.
Well, it was a spoof of a horror title.
Okay, a spoof.
Yeah, and this is also the Nintendo version. This isn't the original Commodore version.
Yeah, let me see if I can find that. Yeah. But this was early, would you say early 80s?
It came out in 1987.
Late 80s, okay. Mm-hmm. So, because we were talking before the show, and I had really gotten engrossed in text adventures, you know, Crowther and Wood's original adventure in Colossal Cave, and then Zork came along in the Infocom games. And I played a lot of those, of course. And I mentioned, I thought it'd be really cool to play those again. And they're not that. It's too much. It's a lot of work.
Or maybe I never. I never really got into the text adventures. No, yeah. I played the original adventure in Colossal Cave and stuff on the college mainframe computer, and I dabbled a little bit in Zork, but yeah, I think one of the big impetuses for doing Maniac Mansion was the graphics, that I enjoyed adventure games. I enjoyed, you know, that type of game, but I really wanted graphics and wanted to just be clicking on stuff on the screen and not typing.
So a graphics adventure does a very similar thing, but you have a picture, in the early days, rudimentary picture instead of a word picture. And then you have commands on the screen. So as you say, you can click. You see the commands here.
Yeah, you just have all the words right there on the screen you click on rather than typing them in. I mean, there's some advantages, also some disadvantages. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, text adventure purists really didn't like the graphic adventures because they didn't feel that they had the same, you know, freedom to be entering information and typing stuff. But, you know, I think what I found when I was, you know, researching Maniac Mansion was that, you know, although you could type in, you know, hundreds of different words to text adventures, it really only understood like 10 or 15 words, right? Everything else was just synonyms. And so that's when I kind of boiled it down to the verbs that you see on the Maniac Mansion screen.
You know what you lose? You lose the thrill and frustration of typing examine box, open box, pickup box, throw box, trying every possible verb with the box. And actually, that's the main reason I don't play text adventures anymore. I realize it's a lot of work. It's annoying. So now I might be
a lot of typing.
It's a lot of typing. I might be a little more open to the idea of a graphical adventure. You know, it's so fun to talk to Ron Gilbert. I'll never forget. And my daughter's 25 now, but when she was maybe 5, having her in my lap playing Freddy Fish, he's done some really great games. We are going to take a little break. When we come back, some of the best authors of the year. Really some fun stuff. But first, let me thank our sponsor. We didn't think we were going to have a sponsor for our best of shows, but GoToWebinar came to us and said, hey, we'd like to support you. So I want to support them. And I love GoToWebinar. I've used them forever. I've done a number of webinars. It's the best way to present online one to many, or actually as many, six to many. And when I say many, I mean many. You can do GoToWebinars live with a huge audience, as many as thousands of people. But the best part about GoToWebinar is you can record that live webinar and make it available online for anybody to download and watch and participate in, because it can be really interactive anytime. And that's when you get audiences in the tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands, dare I say millions. GoToWebinar is the best platform ever for interacting with prospects and customers, for teaching, for explaining, for doing what we do here. We love GoToWebinar. Instead of doing a business presentation, flying out somewhere, or putting up a company website, you can interact with your customers, find out about them as they find out about you. And it starts with the easiest way possible. You can literally, on your iPhone or Android phone, create a custom invitation with your company logo, with images that you choose. All the materials for the webinar are branded with your name, which is fabulous. You can get confirmations from your invitees. Even do that on the phone. You can get reminders, or send them rather reminders to seminars coming up tomorrow. Don't miss it. That helps a lot. You don't want people to forget. And in fact, GoToWebinar can even do that all automatically. They have automated email templates too. Once you have your live event recorded, people can still interact with it because the polls work all the time. So let me explain the polls. Every webinar can have up to 20 polls, each with 20 questions. You probably won't do that. That's a lot of questions. But the nice thing is you can prepare a few polls ahead of time to insert into the webinar as you go. But you can do them on the fly, too. So if you're wondering, are people understanding? Are they following along? Are they interested in this topic or that topic? You can literally, on the fly, have a poll question. And the best part is the recorded versions are just as interactive. Those questions pop up. They have a chance to answer it. It's just as if they're watching it live. And I tell you, it makes a huge difference for your audience. They're more engaged. They're having more fun. And you're getting lots more information about them. It's a great way to generate qualified leads. You get all the metrics you want from GoToWebinar's reporting and analytics tool. Web metrics not only to find out if people were interested and to get those leads, but to find out if you did it right, if there's something you didn't do right, get feedback so you can make your next webinar even better. Up to 6 presenters, each of which has a camera, and so your audience can see them, but you can also show your desktop, you could show applications. It's really very visual, very fun, and very easy for you and it totally engaging for your audience. Turn your next presentation into a conversation with GoToWebinar. For more information, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. That's GoToWebinar.com/podcast. And we're so glad we could have GoToWebinar support for our best of episode. Our next guest is a hero of mine. I've interviewed him many, many times. I think he's the smartest guy I ever met. He's really brilliant, but he's also very good at explaining things. He's a fighter for liberty on the internet, but he's also an amazingly good science fiction novelist, both adult and young adult fiction. I'm talking about Cory Doctorow. You probably figured that out already. He's got a brand new book. We talked about Walk Away. This is the newest, Walk Away. And because it's literally just came out, I mean, I think it comes out tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
We just got it yesterday. And so I haven't read very far. So first of all, I tell everybody, don't worry about spoilers. I don't know nothing.
Right.
But I love the start. In fact, the first sentence reminds me a little bit of your daughter, because the character in the beginning is Hubert Vernon Rudolph Clayton Irving Wilson Alva Anton Jeff Harley Timothy Curtis Cleveland Cecil Ollie Edmund Eli Wiley Marvin Ellis Espinoza, henceforth referred to as Hubert, etc. Apparently his parents used the top 20 names from the 1890 census to name him. Your daughter's name, do you mind me saying it? It's on Wikipedia.
No,
I guess it's not a secret. Your daughter's name, not quite so elaborate, Posey Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow.
Yeah.
So was that, maybe that was a little bit of the inspiration for Hubert?
A little bit, yeah. I always figure middle names are things you get for free, right? So I love the idea of hiding a lot of interesting stuff in the middle names. It's like header stuffing for people. You know, when we were naming her, we had a lot of different ideas about what we could name her, and we ended up just going with like our top five. And so, yeah, the joke about Hubert is that his parents were members of the Anonymous Party, and then they became disaffected with it and left it when it adopted a real names policy. And so they gave him all these names as an act of political protest at the Anonymous Party's calumny and cowardice and lack of adherence to its principles. And that's meant to be funny, ha-ha, but it's also meant to be like ha-ha, only serious, because there is this element in the book. A lot of it is about what happens when people who have very strong political beliefs start to compromise on them, and how compromise can slide you from, you know, don't be evil to surveillance capitalism in a bunch of very small steps that you don't even notice you're taking until one day you turn around and, you know, you're letting the NSA put a Prism server in your data center.
A lot of the names in this book are fantastic.
Aww.
And fantastical, like Limpopo and Gizmo von Puddle Ducks and on and on and on. Does that relate to this whole subject of, you know, an ice weasel, which is, of course, a tip of the hat to Debian. Is there a reason the names are so interesting here? What's going on?
Well, yeah, so these are folks who are engaged in this kind of utopian project that's maybe, you could think of it as being built along the lines of Barlow's Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, where they are walking away from mainstream society, walking away from a world where there isn't much place for like normal people anymore, because the 1% has all the robots it needs and has enough idle workers around to keep those few people who are needed to keep the robots running on their toes, because they could be replaced. And the rest of us are kind of surplus to requirements, and they wander off in this disaffected way to build this utopian parallel world. And, you know, when you think about the history of utopian parallel worlds, there's a lot of reinvention. People tend to take on new names. You know, I'm sure if I was to log into your IRC right now, it would be full of people with handles.
Absolutely.
And not so many real names.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
You know, that ability to like decide who you are, it's really key to a lot of people engaged in audacious things. You know, there's this thing that happens whenever we think about people who are, you know, loom large in our history, and we look at them and it turns out that not only did they do this unusual and amazing thing in, you know, leading the March on Selma, or
you know, inventing an amazing technology. They also have lots of other things that are atypical, some of which may not be so great, and some of which turn out to also be amazing considered separately. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to say that we should just let great people get a walk when they're, you know, jerks. But I do think the fact that people who are grandiose enough to want to do something world-changing also are full of other weird ideas, that that's not a coincidence, that it's weird enough to say, oh yeah, the world is screwed up, so I'm going to make a better one, that we shouldn't be surprised when people who do that also have other things that are atypical about them.
We're talking with Cory Doctorow, his newest book, Walk Away. There's so much catching up I have to do with you. Last time we talked, you were living in the UK. You abandoned the UK for Southern California. I'm wondering if you're regretting that now.
Ha. Well, you know, we got out of the UK just ahead of Brexit, and we landed really just in time for Trump.
Good timing.
And, you know, if there's a lesson there, it's that we can't outrun whatever crisis we're in the middle of that history will later have a name for, that Walkaway is really a novel about the response to. That, you know, my friends in Hungary and in Poland and in the Philippines, and even in Australia for years had been saying, oh, you know, you think that things are so sane and sensible there in the UK and that we're all nuts where we are and that our crazy, awful, extremist government with its bizarre policies and climate denial and whatnot, that those are that's some kind of indictment of our national character as opposed to like an early warning sign of something going on across the world. Well, you just wait, right? It's coming for you too. And you know, I just actually just reviewed this book. Let me see if I can. I just put it on my shelf behind me. Oh, I don't know where I put it. The Canada Land Guide to Canada that was published by this guy, Jesse Brown, who's got this amazing Canada Land podcast. That's really a catalog of all the ways that Canada is not the reasonable, sane paradise that we think it is. It's just got great PR. And there's not really anywhere you can go to outrun these problems. There we go. The Canada Land Guide to Canada. And, you know, Jesse points out that, like, if looking great with your shirt off is a real qualification for leadership, then Putin would be the greatest leader the world had ever seen. And, you know, the fact that we have this charismatic leader in Canada does not mean that Canada is a place where we can ride out this weird global crisis that we're in the middle of. So one of the things Walkaway is supposed to be is an optimistic disaster novel. It's about the theory that what distinguishes a disaster from a catastrophe is not whether something wrong happens, because that just happens, right? You're going to have rising seas or belligerent neighbors or, you know, mutating microbes or a meteor strike, no matter how well organized your society is. So what really matters is not how well it works, but what happens when it fails. And Walkaway is a novel about people who, when things start to go wrong, pitch in to help each other instead of turning on one another. And also about the idea that elites in that moment tend to see not normal people banding together to make things better, but a mob in potentia that needs to be preemptively struck against. And that it is based on this amazing book by Rebecca Solnit, who's an East Bay writer there in Oakland, who wrote this book called Paradise Built in Hell. She's an historian, and she went and looked very closely at contemporaneous first-person accounts of what people did during some of history's great disasters, especially ones that are remembered as being times when people acted badly. And what she finds is that the people on the ground writing about it while it happened saw endless and amazing outpourings of nobility, but the people from a distance, and especially the rich and powerful, saw in this rebuilding great chaos, and they magnified any marginal incidents of bad behavior, of rioting or of looting or whatever, or made it up when they couldn't, when there was none to be found. And that this is this thing that we remember about, you know, Katrina. We remember the rapes in the dome in Katrina, even though they've never been substantiated, and there's no reason to believe that there were ever rapes in the dome in Katrina. And what we don't remember is that in Katrina, the street gangs formed a kind of triage system that systematically sought out the most vulnerable, disabled people and elderly people, and made sure that they got preferential access to water and food and cooling because they were at risk of dying in the dome. And so I wanted to write a story where the tension doesn't come from people behaving badly, but from the certainty that people will behave badly and that that gets in the way of the people who are really behaving in the way that we always hoped we would in times of crisis.
Synthetic bias. This is from a Change Agent right at the beginning. Synthetic biology was the, and I'm not a Jeff Gerner. I'm no Jeff Gerner, but I'll read this for you. Synthetic biology was the transistor of the 21st century. Yet political and this is the thing that is making me sad, but is probably accurate. Political realities in America made it increasingly unfeasible for an entrepreneur there to tinker with the building blocks of life. Every cluster of human cells was viewed as a baby in America. A quarter of the population wasn't vaccinated. The majority of Americans didn't believe in evolution. Social media-powered opinions carried more influence than peer-reviewed scientific research. This is the present. In this virulently anti-science atmosphere, SynBio research was hounded offshore before it had really begun. Activists crowed over their victory. The rest of the world did not let the opportunity pass it by. By then, Silicon Valley's forte, circuitry and software, had become cheap global commodities created everywhere. And you talk about the gig economy. And one of the characters' parents ended up, I think they lived in San Francisco, ended up, their homes were rented out by AIs.
Yes. It's a weaponized Airbnb.
They were huddled.
Debt collection companies will take part of your house and rent it out.
We're not going to foreclose. Good news. You get the living room, but we're renting every other
garage.
Right. You're in the garage.
That's right. It's sort of a twist on I think it was Snow Crash, where people were living in storage units. Here, you'll be shoved into your own garage just to mow the lawn.
This is one of the things. So there's so many things that make your books great, but this is one of the things that everybody who's watching this show, and we're all into technology, when we read these, you get this frisson of excitement because you go, yes, we're headed that way. Yes. But it is very, and I think, you know, Kill Decision was a little political too.
It was.
There is a warning.
Technology is political. It is political. It transforms the social landscape. It just does. And it's how we wield power. If you think about the power that technology has over our lives, I could argue that it has in some ways more power over you than the government every moment of our lives.
Absolutely.
And so,
yeah. So there's a little warning that if we continue to turn away from science in this country,
yes,
we will lose our lead in technology,
yeah,
and become a second-rate power.
Yes.
And countries that are looking forward-looking, like Singapore. I think Singapore is a really good choice. For a while I was worried it was going to be the Chinese century. Mm-hmm. But they have their own economic and political struggles,
yes,
there. Singapore.
Well, even the Chinese went to Singapore.
They went to Singapore.
To go to school on how it worked. This
right.
Tiny island nation, how they were able to transform themselves. Now, of course, they have issues with politics,
little,
as we know.
It's a little authoritarian there.
Little. You could say, as some people say, it's benign. Some people don't. But what interested me was, again, where the rubber meets the road, what they were doing,
yes,
what that means to us.
And sometimes maybe it takes an authoritarian government to set a path that maybe the people don't get or don't support, but that single vision, I'm not supporting authoritarianism in any way, but that singular vision can be an economic engine.
I would also say this, and maybe this is in some ways what you're saying, that if they choose to do that and start to succeed, it puts a fire under our butts to get our act together.
Yeah. Well, we should be feeling that fire.
Look what Sputnik did, right?
That's right.
Sputnik really focused America.
That's right.
And we sort of overcompensated and went to the moon, almost immediately.
Yeah. No. But I still believe that the way we do things here is the best way to do things.
And it's messy.
It's messy. It's fractious.
Just the way I like it.
Slow. But it's not over yet.
Yes.
But this is a warning.
It is an admonition.
An admonition.
It is putting people on notice that Silicon Valley will decamp if it needs to in order to explore the future.
Yeah.
And like I said, I wasn't predicting that the people in Silicon Valley would personally lose their edge, but that the brilliant minds there might go elsewhere.
And we're at risk now.
We
I think we're right on the
edge. So we have to treat science seriously.
Yeah.
We have to be evidence-based in our thinking, decision-making. It's not an option. And again, you don't get to the moon by going like this. Yeah. You do the math.
Don Dodge is our guest. He's developer advocate for Google. And we were going through his checkered past. How did you get to know Ray Ozzie? How did you go to Groove? This was after Lotus, right?
Yes. Ray started Lotus Notes. And Lotus, of course, was a spreadsheet company, best known for spreadsheets.
Mitch Kapor, another great... New England, actually... Silicon Valley has this reputation, but really... A lot of amazing stuff came out of New England, including VisiCalc, as well as Lotus.
Right. Dan Bricklin.
Dan Bricklin.
And yeah, Bob Frankston.
Yep. Mitch. Yeah. Mitch is amazing. So Ozzy was doing Notes, which was a collab, for people who don't know, a collaborative email/database environment. It was file sharing. It was all the stuff that you do now, just kind of secondhand. I mean, second nature. But it was hard to do in those days, pre-internet days.
Very hard to do. Yeah. So he did Notes, which was a enterprise server-based kind of collaboration environment, file sharing, email, that sort of thing. And then he sold it to IBM and made a ton of money. And Ray wanted to do the next thing. So that was basically Lotus Notes in a peer-to-peer environment.
Oh, how interesting.
So it basically took the Lotus Notes model and took it off the enterprise server and put it on a peer-to-peer kind of environment and added things like file sharing and work groups and all this kind of thing. So it was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah. And now I understand their interest in you because of the database background, the peer-to-peer background at Napster.
Right.
It was
a perfect fit.
Yeah.
Because I started my career at Digital Equipment doing database systems, and it turns out Ray Ozzy was also there.
Oh, no kidding.
Many, many years ago. And then after having the database experience and then the Napster peer-to-peer experience, I sort of went from the dark side to the white side doing it for business and enterprise.
You wrote about working with Ray, and you said that people know him, of course. Everybody does know him. He became the CTO at Microsoft and is known as being this visionary and so forth. But you say he's also, people don't know how funny he is.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's Bill Gates said Ray Ozzy is one of the five best programmers in the world.
Wow.
And coming from Bill Gates, that's very high praise. And he is. He is brilliant. A brilliant programmer, a brilliant architect and visionary. He's a big picture guy. And basically, Microsoft acquired Groove Networks to get Ray Ozzy. Ray Ozzy took over for Bill Gates as chief software architect. That's what allowed Bill Gates to retire from Microsoft.
Do you think that was the plan when Microsoft acquired Groove?
That wasn't what they said, but that's absolutely what
Bill
it was.
Bill had it in mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Gates wanted to retire.
I can't leave unless I have somebody I know and I can trust that's got the brains. And
that's right.
Ray Ozzy makes perfect sense. I have to ask what happened, because everybody had high hopes and thought, man, this is going to be very exciting. And nothing really happened, it seems like. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong. Well, one thing that you can say Ray Ozzy did was Microsoft Azure. So he saw the future. He saw that the cloud was going to be a big thing. And he invented Azure. So he went off and built his own little separate group and had the vision for cloud computing and Azure. And that has Ray Ozzy's fingerprints all over it. He was the architect.
You could argue that's Microsoft's biggest business. Certainly, the cloud is their biggest business these days. But at the time, Steve Ballmer was still running the joint.
Right. So it was an almost impossible situation. You had Bill Gates, the legend, and then you had Steve Ballmer, the CEO and co-legend. And then Ray coming in to try to be the chief software architect and visionary and move the company forward in many different directions. He certainly had the brain power and the vision and the gravitas to do that. But coming into Microsoft, where there were billionaire, brilliant business leaders in each of those segments, like Microsoft Office or SQL Server or Windows Server. These groups were gigantic multi-billion dollar businesses on their own. So having someone come in from the outside and try to manage that and be the visionary for it was a nearly impossible job.
Yeah, and again, you were on the inside. We were all, you know, as a tech journalist on the outside, but it did look as if, in fact, I know you've seen the famous cartoon, which I have hanging on my wall at home. The artist sent it to me, of all the guns. They had the org charts for all the different companies, and Microsoft, it's every group pointing guns at each other. It was at that time, and I think a lot of credit to Satya Nadella, he seems to have reinvented it, but at that time, a very political organization.
Incredibly political. Yeah. Yeah. And very powerful people. And that's just not Ray. He's not a political guy. He's not a sort of organizational guy that wants to build the big fiefdom and be a corporate guy. That's not who he is. He is a visionary, a brilliant computer scientist. He can see the future, but putting him in the Microsoft environment was a real challenge.
Here's the famous org chart. Amazon looking pretty hierarchical. Google looking like a cat's cradle. Everybody reporting to everybody else. Facebook even more of a network. And then, of course, Microsoft with different divisions, each pointing guns at one another. Actually, I like the last two, which is Apple, one person in the middle, everybody else revolving around that, and Oracle, which has a normal org chart, but it's tiny compared to the giant org chart for legal. I love having this, and I think I can't try to remember, is it Ray Avila who drew it? I have to thank the original artist, Joey Davila, that's right, who drew it, because it is very, very funny, and there's the Microsoft piece of it. That hurt Microsoft. I think it was one of the things that held Microsoft back for a long time.
Going to China has got to be probably the most eye-opening, because I did manage to slip inside the iconic Longhua factory and interview the workers who toil there, who actually put these things together. And, you know, it was a really, really eye-opening experience to meet and to see that firsthand, to see how far things had come since the suicide epidemics of 6 or 7 years ago. It's such an important part of the device's story, is how it gets made, how it gets manufactured, and just this reminder that there are human hands, hundreds of thousands of them, who make it possible, who perform one repetitive task and move on and just, you know, dedicate large portions of their lives to creating these devices so we can have them in our pockets.
I mean, part of reading this book, I wanted you to solve that moral dilemma that I have, and I think so many other people have, that, you know, we love the environment, and, you know, we feel like we are, you know, human rights advocates, and yet we also love our iPhones. And can those two be joined? You unfortunately didn't solve that moral dilemma for me. You said you saw that, you snuck out, you asked to go to the bathroom, snuck around. You said it didn't look like there were any workers there that were younger than 16, but you write that there was still a different kind of ugliness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in the interviews that I did with the workers, some themes kept emerging. The most striking and the most disturbing was they kept referring to this sort of ghost of death that haunts the place, this fact of life that death is normal. They say if you go to Foxconn, you just live with it. Death is normal. So it's really this new sort of culture that's there that you live with the fact that it's the conditions are so psychologically difficult that suicide is a fact of life. And that is largely because of the work culture. You know, it's not so much that, you know, people are blowing out their arms or breaking their, you know, or physically, you know, feeling the strain of this stuff. It's very psychological, and that starts with the management culture, which can be very cruel. That's another theme I heard over and over, that you know, workers there who are doing 12-hour shifts, standing on their feet, doing this repetitive motions. If they screw up, you know, in any significant way, they're liable to be singled out. Their floor managers will have them stand up and publicly shamed at the end of the day and said, this is why we didn't meet quota today. Zhu did it. It's his fault. Will you apologize and make sure this never happens again? So it's this immense amount of pressure where you don't know a lot of people. Oftentimes you've migrated from a rural, more impoverished part of the country. You're in these giant factories, these towering monoliths of industry. It was insane how big they were, how gray, how drab, how small it made you feel, how little there was in that environment. I mean, remember, these factories house and are the workplace to hundreds of thousands of people. 500,000 people worked in Longhua at its height. And it's in one factory block, one ginormous city state of a factory. It takes you about an hour and a half to walk across the whole thing. And there's really nothing. I didn't see any public parks or any places to sit. You saw there was a 7-Eleven where you could go spend some money and some cyber cafes where you could go spend some money. But the sum total effect was indeed this sort of grim kind of place that was designed for maximum efficiency, for production, and for little else. It was just, as one of the Foxconn workers told me, I quote, "It's not a good place for human beings," and that really just resonated, and it felt true as I walked through those factory blocks.
And for you personally, did that change the way you look at your iPhone or your use of your iPhone?
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe it's a little cliche to say, but my phone does feel a little bit heavier now. It feels like a much more complex, much more morally complex device.
You know, I read a tweet about a week ago from our next guest, Nick Bilton. You know Nick, he's been on our shows many times. He was at the New York Times, went to Vanity Fair, wrote a number of great books, Hatching Twitter, about the history of Twitter, his latest about the Silk Road. It's called American Kingpin. In fact, it's about to be made into a major motion picture. And good news, Nick is writing the screenplay. So I'm sure we've lost him to Hollywood. But he tweeted the other day, if you had bought $1 worth of Bitcoin in 2010, in March 2010, $1 worth of Bitcoin, what do you think it would be worth today? More than $6 million. Nick didn't do it. I didn't do it. But Nick is continuing to write, thank goodness. Megan Maroney talked to him a little bit about his book, American Kingpin.
I'm very excited to speak to Nick Bilton, who's the author of American Kingpin. He is a writer at The Hive, at Vanity Fair, formerly from The New York Times, and a previous guest on Twit many times. Thank you. It's so nice to meet you, Nick Bilton. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You have one of those names where I'm tempted to say it all in one. Nick Bilton. Do you experience that a lot?
People do that on Twitter. No, I always have to spell my last name. No one gets it. I have to say Hilt. It's like Hilton, but with a B. Or, you know, B as in boy, I-L-T-O-N. So
let's talk about your book. It came out in May. I really enjoyed it. It was, of course, about Ross Ulbricht, and he was the founder of the Silk Road. And so many of us in technology, of course, followed this story with bated breath. So, you know, if you haven't, there will be some spoilers here. But what's amazing about this book really isn't the fact that Ross Ulbricht got caught and will spend the rest of his life in jail, probably, but really just how he got caught, the efforts to which he went to not get caught, and what brought him to creating the Silk Road, this Amazon for drugs, in the first place. So, you know, this guy who started off as a Boy Scout, like literally helping old ladies walk across the street, how he ended up thinking that he was going to take people's lives, et cetera. So let's start with what inspired you to write about Ross?
Well, I was a reporter at the New York Times. I was a columnist. And so as a columnist, you kind of, if your beat is technology, it's not, not just writing about, you know, Uber or Apple or something. You're literally writing about all sorts of different technologies and how they're changing society and the world and so on. And sometimes it's companies and sometimes it's not. And the thing that, I'd written about hackers and Lulzsec and all these different groups, and I'd written a little about the dark web, and I was always fascinated by how quickly these things were changing. And I lived in an area of San Francisco at the time called Glen Park. And Glen Park is this kind of sleepy, not so much anymore, but at the time was this very sleepy little area of the city. And I used to go to these coffee shops and walk past this library every day with my dog and walk through this park. And when Ross Ulbricht was arrested at a public library, actually in Glen Park, very near my house, it turned out he lived very close to me and was operating this website where he was making hundreds of millions of dollars selling drugs and guns and ordering hits and murder for hire and so on. And he literally could have been sitting next to me in a coffee shop or the sushi restaurant that we both went to or something like that. And I found that so fascinating that we live in an era where, you know, Pablo Escobar could be shopping at the same grocery store of you and you just have no idea.
So had you, I know you probably had heard about the Silk Road the same way most of us had from Adrian Chen's Gawker article. Was that, I think, 2010 when he wrote that?
No, 2011 that he wrote it, June of 2011.
So, but had you done any research? Like, was that your beat at all following the Silk Road or were people looking for Ross?
No, it wasn't really my beat. I'd done some research, you know. I think I'd written a column or so or two maybe on Bitcoin or digital currencies. I'd helped some reporters out that were working on dark web stories, you know, the co-workers. But I'd read about it. I read Adrian's story. I went to the dark web and snooped around for 5 minutes and thought, wow, that's pretty cool and crazy and insane that someone would have the guts to do that. But I didn't, I hadn't written any big exposés. I was looking into writing a big piece for the Sunday Business section when it all came crashing down. But it was just a, you know, everyone at the New York Times knew about it, but it was also kind of this thing that it was unclear how big it was. No one knew how big the Silk Road was, and how long it would go on for.
So I want to talk a little bit about the research. I mean, your book is so detailed down to the words that people use. Ross is, you know, just like he would say fudge instead of the other F word that we're all familiar with. And so I know you never talked to him, like he wouldn't talk to you. Talk a little bit about how you did your research for this book.
Well, in my last book, Hatching Twitter, which was about the chaos that brought Twitter to where it is today and infighting and backstabbing. At first, when I first started reporting that, none of the board members that I spoke to, none of them wanted to talk to me. None of the big players. And so what I did was I started going, and they eventually all spoke to me, but in the beginning they didn't. And so the way I got there was I started looking at their Twitter feeds over the years and seeing what they had tweeted about at certain events and moments and things like that. And it shed a lot of light on who these people were. And so they spoke to me without actually speaking to me. And so the same thing happened with American Kingpin. You know, Ross Ulbricht had lived his life mostly online for several years, either as the Dread Pirate Roberts running the website or as Ross Ulbricht communicating with his friends and writing things about libertarian beliefs on social media. And so we originally, I have a researcher that I work with, and we went through and we took all of the stuff off social media that he had shared over the years, you know, thousands of posts and photos and videos and comments and things like that. And we put it into a database based on time. And then we started going through all the evidence that was put into evidence in New York at the trial. And then I started doing what I do as a reporter and getting things that other people had, including emails he'd sent to friends and girlfriends and family and photos and videos of him, and eventually chat logs from the conversations he had had with his employees. And all this stuff added up to, it was probably like 5-6 million words of stuff. And we put it all into this database, and then we could kind of cross correlate it. So for example, and it all added up, you know, just unbelievably perfectly. So for example, when the Dread Pirate Roberts, who ran the Silk Road, would say, oh, I'm going away for the weekend to his employees, I want you to manage the site, he would log off. and you would see Ross Ulbricht, the real human being, go on Facebook and say, off to go camping this weekend. And then when he returned, you know, there would be a photo that Ross or one of his friends would post on Facebook, and of that camping trip and the timestamps and so on. And the Dread Pirate Roberts would log back on and talk about a great weekend he had with his friends and a girl he met. And this happened thousands and thousands of times in the chat logs and the social media accounts and so on. And then you couple that with the interviews that I did, which was probably, I don't know, a few hundred hours, maybe 1,000 hours of interviews with law enforcement, going to the places that these events happened, the library where he was arrested and so on. And you're able to paint this picture of this incredibly detailed story that's better than spending 1,000 hours with Ross asking him questions.
Yeah, I mean, because at this point, what would his answers be? Like, yeah, would he tell you more?
Yeah. He's not going to say, oh, actually, yeah, I did try to kill those people. No, he thinks that one day he's going to be pardoned or some sort of appeal process will go through. And I think that, I wouldn't speak to me. You know, I saw him at the trial. I covered his trial for the paper. I met his family and so on and so forth. It makes total sense that, you know, that one wouldn't speak to a reporter who's writing a book. But what I don't think Ross ever realized, either as a Dread Pirate Roberts or as himself, he never realized, A, he was going to get caught. He didn't think that was ever going to happen. But B, he had no comprehension of all these things that he was keeping on his computer, from his diary entries to his chat logs to the spreadsheets and things like that, that they would ever be put into evidence against him. And it all kind of backfired in a way that I don't think anyone who was involved in the site could have ever imagined.
We all are in the shadow of Walt Mossberg. So no. I think everybody knows this, but just a quick recap, you know, Wall Street Journal for many years created the Code Conference with Wall Street Journal, All Things D, eventually spun that off. You and Kara spun it off to your own business, Kara Swisher, and then sold to Vox. And then in June, you shocked us all by saying, this is my last column.
Well, I actually, in April, announced that I would be doing my last column in shortly after the Code Conference, which ends in June. And that's what happened. I am now retired for a huge 5 weeks. I have 5 weeks of retirement under my belt, so I am a retirement expert. My idea of retiring was really, and I explained this in the post, to reinvent myself, which is something I've done, and as you just pointed out, a number of times in my career. Got to remember, I started off covering and spent 20 years covering Washington policy and politics before I ever started being a tech writer. And so there have been a number of reinventions, and I just think of this as another one. You know, I'm not doing things on a weekly or daily cadence anymore, but I'm writing a book. I'm involved in a kind of crusade for news literacy, which we can talk about if you want. And I have some other things up my sleeve, which I'm probably not going to talk about.
So I won't say, how has retirement been then? It sounds like you're not really particularly retired.
Well, I am retired. I mean, I don't.
You're not raising squashes out in the back or anything.
No. I'm not doing that. And I'm not spending a lot of time lying on the hammock. But I have actually spent more time with my family in the last 5 weeks than in the previous, I don't know, 5 years or something, which is great. And I'm going to continue doing that and doing some travel and some speaking. But you're right. I'm not living in Boca on the beach. I mean, I am working on a book and these other things.
You wielded and probably continue to wield immense power in Silicon Valley. I found Ken Auletta's quote from his New Yorker profile of you in 2007. He said, "Walt Mossberg is someone whose judgment can ratify years of effort or sink the show." Did that power ever concern you? How did that feel to you personally?
Well, it never felt as dramatic as Kendall Lenham made it sound.
But Walt, it was true. I mean, people came to you and wanted your seal of approval, and you know, without it, it was tough.
No, well, there are plenty of things that succeeded that I thought were suboptimal, and there were some things I liked a lot that didn't succeed.
What did you hate? Tell me something.
Very much. Wait, before we get to that, yeah, I mean, okay. The analogy, the correct analogy, the way to think about it is, you know, I decided in 91 to be kind of a movie critic for tech products or a book reviewer for tech products. So, and I had a big platform, which was the Wall Street Journal. And so just like a movie critic or a book reviewer, there are things you will like, you will praise, but which go on to, you know, not sell in big numbers. There are things you will say, geez, this is really lousy, or, you know, not as good as six other things, yeah. But the public will buy them anyway. And that never bothered me. I was not interested in driving sales or hurting sales. It did happen. You know, you mentioned Ken Aletta, who is a New Yorker media writer who very well known, who did that piece. But Wired did a piece on me also. And at that time, they did a chart, and I had never paid any attention to this, but they did a chart kind of showing, I can't remember whether the sales or stock prices or something.
They called you the kingmaker.
Yeah, they did. But the interesting thing was they had this chart that showed, you know, a certain product I had reviewed and what happened to their sales or their stock following the review, positive or negative. So, you know, people paid attention to that. But I really, honest to God, I know it sounds corny, but I really was just trying to give my opinion in a way that would help average people. Because I thought, and this is really the reason I started the column, I thought the industry was not aiming its efforts at average people, and instead was really aiming its efforts at techies and enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be the champion of average people, and that's what I was right to the end.
Yeah. Our guest today is Lila Jana. She's the founder and CEO of two very interesting companies, which we'll talk about in a second, SamaSource and LXMI. Or do you pronounce that 60
Luxme.
Luxme. Not even close. Hi, Lila. Welcome. Welcome to Triangulation. It's great to have you. And I'm going to mispronounce your name at least once, so I'm warning you. L-E-I-L-A, Lila Jana, J-A-N-A-H. So you went to Harvard. You've been a distinguished professor or associate at Stanford. You have a very upscale education and background. And yet you've decided that you want to reverse poverty one job at a time. How did you come to this?
Sure.
You're also a founder, an entrepreneur. Yeah,
I am. I love that you think that I have an upscale background. I did get the very fortunate chance to go to Harvard for undergrad, but I actually came from a pretty low income background. My parents were immigrants here, and to get through college, I had three jobs. So
wow.
Part of my mission is to show people that you don't have to be a trust fund kid to go into social enterprise or nonprofit work, that there are many amazing institutions that will support you in doing this work.
Neat. When did you first become interested in reversing poverty? How did this become an issue for you?
So I accidentally fell into this field. I had desperately wanted to leave Los Angeles. I was a high school student there, and I had gotten a scholarship from a tobacco company, of all places, the Lorillard Tobacco Company, for doing community service in high school. And I felt
this
weird.
This was their penance for making everybody sick with cigarettes.
Exactly. They were giving away money to, you know, first-generation kids better. Like me to feel better about themselves. And rather than taking it and using it for college, which felt a little bit weird to me, I thought, well, maybe I can use it to go do some volunteer work. And I had also wanted to get out of L.A. And so the stars aligned, and I managed to graduate a semester early and go.
I love what you did.
It was an adventure and really just inspired by my desire to leave home before college.
You went to Ghana.
I went to Ghana, and I was assigned to teach English at a school for blind children in a rural town about 2.5 hours north of the capital. I'd never been to Africa before. I had no family ties there. I'd read a little bit about West Africa, but I had no idea what I was getting into.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd go there and I'd save these poor African children and teach them English. And like so many international volunteers, I got schooled. My students could name U.S. senators. They were incredibly
something
bright.
A lot of American students can't do. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, they could talk about Bill Clinton had made an official state visit to Africa, the first in decades, I think, and everybody in Ghana was so excited about it. And my students were listening to Voice of America and BBC Radio, and they spoke the Queen's English.
Yeah.
And it dawned on me that we have this myth about poor people, that they don't have the skill or the will to work. And so often, especially in very poor parts of developing countries, you have this immense talent pool that's totally untapped in global markets.
Mm-hmm. And have a thirst for knowledge and education and the chance to succeed and just don't have that opportunity.
Absolutely. And it dawned on me. I mean, if you are lucky enough to be born in America or a developed country, you benefit, at least in theory, from public institutions. I went to public school my whole life. My parents came to this country with nothing. My brother and I lived the American dream. And so I assumed that that was just possible for anyone who was willing to work hard enough and do well in school. And that's just patently untrue, obviously. Yeah. We live in a world that's dictated by an accident of birth. Where you happen to be born determines so much of your fate in life, and it needn't be the case.
Yeah, that actually is true even in the U.S., isn't it? I mean, it's not merely where you're born internationally; it's here in the U.S. and how you're born and to whom you're born and the opportunities you get.
And we later started a domestic program here in the U.S. called Sama School, which I get into in the book, and we talk about how challenging it has been to work in communities here in the U.S. which are even more disconnected than parts of Africa, like rural Arkansas, which I talk about, where we had to shut down our program because there was literally not enough internet and the literacy rates were so low.
So when did you start SamaSource?
2008.
Yeah. Three years out of college.
Yes, 3 years out of college and the worst month in the last 100 years. September 2008.
During the economic crisis.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it was a nonprofit.
Yes, it's a 501c3.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I want to build an organization that moves people out of poverty, but uses the mechanism of the market and especially this new kind of digital work to do that.
So this is a unique approach to it. I think one of the things, there's the SamaSource website. One of the things that we see a lot of in this country is celebrities, I won't name names, but you know who they are, going to Africa surrounded by these poor African kids and saying, please give pennies because it can make such a difference in their lives. And I think that it looks to me a little bit more like the continuation of the white man's burden. Like, you know, we've got civilization and it's our job to, if we don't colonize them anymore, but it's effectively economically colonize people to give them, you know, what we have. You don't come to it from that point of view.
No, and you know, the thing about that model is that it's fundamentally patronizing.
It's horrible.
It sets up a relationship of us versus them, where them are these faceless, nameless, poor people who are desperate and needy, and it doesn't require us to examine the structures that lead to that situation. And if you really believe that talent is equally distributed, which I fundamentally do, then the only explanation for such extreme disparities in wealth is disparities in opportunity. And that's what we aim to solve at SamaSource. Yeah. We are about giving people work rather than aid, which is a much more empowering relationship. It's saying, I value what you bring to the table. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to show you that the market values what you bring to the table, even if you are a poor young woman from a slum in Nairobi, which is one of the toughest places to grow up in a slum in the world.
So, yeah, tell me about some of the places that you go and that we can make a difference in.
Sure. So I should say Sama means equal in Sanskrit. It's actually the root word for same in English.
Nice. I like it.
And the whole mission of SamaSource is to connect people who are living under the local poverty line which in most developing countries is under about $2 or $3 a day, and to connect them to work that pays a living wage through technology. So we actually manage what's now the largest data services company in East Africa.
Wow.
And all of the workers come from extremely low income backgrounds. So under about $2.20 a day. To give you an idea of what that's like, it means you live in a slum. So you live in a mud walled hut with a tin roof over your head if you're lucky. You have no sanitation at home. You have no clean drinking water at home. You have no access to proper health care. You are often eating. We find that many of our workers at that income level before they start with us are literally eating sugar cane as a primary source of calories because it's so cheap. So you're really living a life that no human being should be subjected to in 2017. And very quickly, once we hire people, we quadruple their incomes. What's remarkable is they stay at that income level even after they leave Samasor. So they move out of poverty permanently. And we hire them to do what we call micro work, small digital tasks for large technology and data companies around the world.
Does this model work everywhere?
It has worked really well in East Africa. We have now about 1,300 full-time workers in Kenya and Uganda.
Doing
we
what?
We also have a center in India and Haiti. They're mostly doing various tasks for technologies of the future. One of the biggest areas that we specialize in is image tagging for computer vision. So the teams that are building self-driving car technology and other machine learning technologies, making machines smarter. Those teams need high quality data, and we provide that training data for those algorithms. So, believe it or not, you know, if you're in a car that's self-driving or that's experimenting with self-driving, that data may have been created by someone who has moved out of poverty as a result of this business model.
I'm speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is one of the minds behind the expansive universe that is The Expanse. And Daniel, we have to talk about it now because it has absolutely taken off in the last couple of years. Did you know that The Expanse was going to be this kind of a hit, this kind of a cultural phenomenon when you first started producing it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, you never know that this is going to hit. I knew that it was fun, and I knew that it was something that we enjoyed doing, and I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And I was pretty sure, worst case scenario, we could sell it for a few thousand bucks and buy some pizza. And that was the plan. The plan was we would write Leviathan Wakes. We would sell it for about as much as I had sold my first novels, which we would then split and, you know, pay some bills, buy some groceries. That was it. That was the plan. We have overshot.
Yeah, just a little bit. Now, originally, Ty had designed the Expanse universe as a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, and then later as a tabletop game. You came to Ty and you said, No. You've done far too much research to stop there. This needs to be turned into something full-fledged. What was that conversation like?
That conversation was more like, hey, you already did all the hard part. Why don't we write this down? I was playing in one of the iterations of the tabletop game. There were several. There were several versions of that got played through all in the same setting, different places in the universe. And I was playing on Ceres Station, working for Star Helix Security, and my character was Detective Miller. And I every time I came up with a question, what does the quarter look like? How does the water supply work? How did the money work? Ty knew the answer. He had it all at his fingertips. He had spent so much time thinking about the universe that it was done. It was complete. And the story was awesome, and the games were fun. And I was thinking, you know, really, you just write this down. It's a pretty good book. And so I said we should write this and split the money. And he had never written a book before. He'd written a short story, too, and done quite well with them, and thought it would be interesting and fun to try writing a novel. So and the original plan was that he would tell me what to write, because I'd written novels. I knew how to write novels. He would tell me what happened, and I'd write it down, and that would be how we did it. And so he told me what the beginning looked like, and I wrote it, and I handed it to him. He said, yeah, this is close, but can I? And So we threw out all of my stuff, and he wrote the beginning, and I edited it. And then I wrote the next thing, and he edited that. And then that became the process where each of us would write a chapter, and the other guy would edit that chapter, and we'd swap off until at this point we both internalized the other guy's process well enough that we don't have to do it quite so religiously anymore. But it was something where we learned that process as we were working together on that first book. And when we were done with the book, the idea was that we'd sell it. And of course, when you sell things, it's easier to sell things when it looks like there might be more later on if it goes well. So we hadn't really planned that, but it seemed like a good idea. So we, as part of just the process, we're putting the sales pitch together. We came up with some ideas for a couple other books that maybe might be able to follow the Leviathan. And we needed to then need to come up with a series name because that makes it sound like it's a series. And I didn't know what that was going to be. So we said, okay, well, that's a synonym for big.
And there you have it.
And then it happened.
I'm glad that you brought up that the vignette about how he always had the answers, because that's that research that came into play. In fact, if you switch Carsten to my screen here, there was this scene early in the episode, first episode of the screenplay, the adaptation of the books, where you're showing. Now this could be a throwaway scene to non-geeks, but geeks look at this. And this was the first indication I had of they're going to take this seriously. You know, they've actually gone through the process of understanding how the physics would work on a spinning body that's trying to generate artificial gravity via centripetal force or centrifugal force. And when I saw this, I said, okay, I'm going to like this. And I think it was the same thing for most of fandom. We've got Specs in our chat room who's saying there's a delicious realism, even though I know that all of this is fanciful, there's a delicious realism that keeps me close enough to how I know physics works that makes me buy into the story so much more. Is that all the result of this research?
A great deal of that is the result of Ty's research and of Ty's dedication to not phoning in the science. And it's been something that we've struggled with. We've had generations of science fiction on television and in movies that has educated us incorrectly. Right. So that even when we get it right now, it looks weird. And trying to get close, trying to get that plausibility, has been really hard. It's been really tricky, and it's made, I think, a show that has a different feel than anything else. Just because you are reminded over and over that it's not magic.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that hooked me. After the first series, I was completely hooked because there was no magic tech. I think the closest you get to magic tech is probably the Epstein drive and the juice that keeps me from turning into a puddle at high G's. Other than that, I mean, it's not, as you mentioned, it's not what I expect from sci-fi. There's no artificial gravity. There's no warp drive that instantly gets me from one place to the next. There's no transporters. There's no magical material that can survive being hit by a micrometeoroid at millions of kilometers an hour.
And there's no shields.
And there's no shields, exactly. And the weaponry they use on the series, it's, I can imagine it, rail guns, Gatling guns, and missiles. Okay, yeah, we've got those. But it makes it harder to make sci-fi when you're trying to be real, right? I mean, it would be so much easier if you could add one or two elements of traditional space sci-fi and say, yeah, we don't have to worry about taking a shuttle from the ship to the station because I just transport over.
It makes it different. But part of what defines the feeling about any project, show, book, story, whatever, is the choice of obstacles. If you have no obstacles at all, it's going to be a terrible story. That's just if the rules can be anything for it every scene, that's terrible. So by choosing the obstacles, by choosing a different set of obstacles than the usual, it does mean we have to think things through. It does mean sometimes we have to chew things out that we wouldn't have had to do if we'd done something more familiar. But it also means we get things that nobody else has gotten to do because we have other things to work around. Mark and Hawk, Mark Ferguson, Hawk Ospey, who wrote the pilot and who really launched this whole thing, the guys who did Iron Man and Children of Men, were talking about light delay because we have light delay in the show. If something's going on Jupiter and you're on Earth, you're 40 minutes behind the start. And they were talking about how cell phones have destroyed the thriller genre because everybody can just call and tell people what's going on anytime they want to. It's hard to have that tension of withheld information. And light delay gives you some part of that back because something's going on and you need to get information to them. And it is physically impossible for that information to arrive until maybe the whole thing's already been decided. So that's something narratively we get back.
It's always fun to get to talk to our science fiction writers, our heroes, and I'm kind of jealous of Padre that he got to talk to Daniel Abraham. By the way, that is one thing you've noticed already and has changed a lot this year. Instead of me doing all the interviews, hogging them all to myself, we've got the whole team doing it. So Megan Maroney and Jason Howell and Father Robert and I will kind of rotate, and we each get to pick people we're really interested in. I picked a guy I've known for years and I've admired for years. I don't think I've ever met him. He's really a legend in the business. He came to America a penniless, illegal immigrant from France because he couldn't get a real job. He had to start his own company. It was called, you might remember it, Borland International. And he brought Turbo Pascal to the United States, a programming language that literally changed everything. But that wasn't all he did. Among other things, he also invented the camera phone. Yes, the technology that we use today in the camera phone. Philippe talks about it on this segment from Triangulation. Our guest is one of the most important people in the history of Silicon Valley. And unlike so many people who were there at the very beginning, he's still very active. And you're probably bored to tears, but 20 years ago, you did something really important that changed everybody's life, and it was at the birth of your daughter, who'd now be 20 years old, right?
She is 20 years old. She's a student at NYU, and she's a great kid. She is 20 years old.
Isn't that cool? That's so cool.
You know, it's a very simple story, and it's really a lot of so-called inventions happen that way. There's always a kind of a catalyst moment, and so what happened is that I was working for about a year after we sold a company to Motorola. Company that did the first
Starfish
credit card size Starfish credit card size organizer and stuff like that. So that was acquired by Motorola. They wanted to integrate that into their phones, and so I actually thought that with the web, it was 1996, the web was, 3 years old, really. There was really no easy way to intelligently share media. Basically, people would send media via email attachments and stuff like that. So I built a server that was able to take an attachment of a picture, store it, and then send notifications to a whole bunch of people in an email list that there was an attachment, a picture that they with a so the notification had a callback URL to that picture, so that if people said, hey, Philippe has a new picture that you could take a look at, and so you didn't need to send 2,000 pictures to people who you wanted, you just sent a notification, the server sent a notification with URL coming back, and then if you click that, then you saw the picture, as opposed to, brute force sending 2,000 pictures. That's exactly how Instagram or Facebook and all these guys work today, right? So we're talking about that thing. So I had been working on that server for quite a while. And then I was working on what we'd call today the edge device, the device that would actually create the content, which had to be some form of a combination of a digital camera and some kind of wireless system if I wanted to be able to do that anywhere, anytime. Wireless systems were limited at the time because it was 1,200 baud analog phones, really, StarTAC phone. And the first successful digital camera with the Casio QV10 or whatever it is, I think the bandwidth in this house is going down because somebody is doing stuff with the bandwidth.
You got a teenager BitTorrent?
you're seeing the quality go down.
It looks okay, right? At this end.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it looks okay. Looks better than that very first picture of your newborn daughter in June 11th, 1997. This is the invention. Well, that was a picture. Look at that. That's the first camera phone picture. Wow. Look at that.
That was 240 by 320 was a quarter VGA resolution. That's all the Casio camera could do at the time. So what you have there is the best resolution we had at the time. And that picture was taken and shared instantly with 2,000 people.
You had a StarTAC phone, a Motorola flip phone.
Yeah, a Casio.
And the Casio camera.
Camera.
Were they connected?
Well.
And by the way, your wife's in labor. Yeah. And actually, I'm sympathetic because when my daughter was born 25 years ago, I used HyperCard. I was busy writing a HyperCard contraction timer because as the father, you got nothing to do. And all you could do is like grit your teeth. So I understand you. The story is that you ran down to the car to get all this stuff while your wife's in labor.
There's a movie that's been made about that.
Is there really?
Yeah, you should see it. It became viral. It actually got a lot of downloads.
Oh,
it's
look for it.
It's a 3-minute movie. We didn't make it. It was made by someone. It's extremely well made. They actually hired actors that kind of look like myself and my wife and everybody else. And it's a high production value thing. And they did a really good job at, I think, it's on Vimeo.
Okay, I'll look for it.
I can send you a link.
Oh, I'm sure
want.
I can. I could probably Google it. That's awesome.
I'm sure.
What does your daughter think about that? I mean, that's...
Oh, she doesn't.
She doesn't. She Snapchats and Instagrams and tweets and doesn't realize that all of that...
No. She does. She does. But she doesn't want to be known as...
I don't blame her.
She wants to be known for her, for what she does. So I'll
What does she do? She's at NYU. Oh, there it is. There's the 1997 Birth of the Camera Phone, Conscious Minds on Vimeo. If you want to, is it pretty accurate, Philippe?
It's unbelievably accurate. We didn't do anything. These guys took all the interviews and everything they could find, and they made this movie. And it's got great.
I love it.
Are you playing it right now?
Yeah, there's the young Philippe Kahn. There's Sonia.
Yeah, the sound.
Pregnant.
Is the sound there?
Yeah,
the sound is good.
We're just not playing all the sound just because we don't want to override you. I'm more interested in what you have to say, but we'll leave this as an exercise for viewers.
The sound is really good.
Okay, let's listen for a little bit then.
Honey.
Oh.
Honey.
Did you grab your phone?
This is all accurate.
He's got his StarTAC. He's looking at his server, and he's thinking.
It's one of the few occurrences where you have a chance to speed and not be stopped.
That's right. Or if you are stopped, you have a good excuse.
Can you slow down?
This is absolutely true. We got stopped.
You did get stopped?
License and registration, please.
So I explained to the officer that we were going to labor. The officer was funny. He said, I heard that line before.
Yeah, but if you look at your wife, it's pretty obvious.
This is 1997. The maternity doesn't have Wi-Fi. Doesn't exist yet. If I wanted to share pictures instantly,
they went through the room.
That's the same room?
Yeah. They actually did their homework.
That's amazing.
How's it going?
Don't have the right cable.
Do you have your soldering iron?
Do you have your soldering iron?
And basically ripped up the whole speakerphone from the car.
Philippe, this is awesome. This is amazing.
This is exactly how it happened. These guys were, they went and interviewed the personnel at the maternity and the OBGYN. And,
wow. Did they, what did the doctors and nurses think? Were they?
The surgeon, she had a C-section. The surgeon loved it. He's a geek. He's a friend. He was more interested in what I was doing than in the baby.
Poor Sonia. But I guess your wife's used to it. She actually, what I love about the story is that she helped you found your companies and helped run them with you.
Oh, she does that with new companies. She's very key. I couldn't do it. I mean, she's the operational person.
And there's the picture. Boom. And that's it.
That's how it happened. And went to a lot of people.
I am very excited today on Triangulation to talk to Leslie Berlin. She is the author of Troublemakers, the Silicon Valley's coming of age. She is also the project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University. I am honored to talk to you, Leslie.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
So let's start. You've made a career out of studying Silicon Valley history. What fascinates you the most about this area?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've always thought that American history really underplays how important technology has been from the very, very beginning. And when I moved out here, which was a long time ago, it was in 1993, I started looking around and realizing, well, this is where so much that determines our lives happened. And that was 1993. I mean, we didn't really even have a functional web at that point. And so now when you think about all the things that you spend your day doing and how dependent you are on your technology and how terrifying it is if you say lose it, it really drives home how much our everyday lives are infused with Silicon Valley, even for people who don't live here.
I know. I mean, you read that it's only 35 square miles. It's not a very big place. I mean, I think the idea of Silicon Valley is a lot bigger than the actual space. Mm-hmm. Why here? Why there? I mean, why in that space? Why did everything develop there?
Well, a couple things came together at the same time. First, Silicon Valley got really, really lucky that the mom of the guy who invented the transistor lived here. And he wanted to be with his mom. His name is William Shockley. He wanted to be with his mother and decided to set up a company here. And the transistor is like a little grain of sand around which the entire Silicon Valley pearl has grown. It's just been layer after layer. And when you look at what came out of the valley and continues to, it's so much of it can be traced back to that transistor. It's like the littlest doll in one of those Russian nesting doll sets. And so the technology was key. That was just plain old luck. Timing was super important as well, because that transistor makes its way here in 1956. And at that point, there really isn't an industrial economy here. It's pretty much orchards. And with a few companies, Hewlett-Packard was here already. But it was the major economy was still fruits and canning fruits. And so what happened was you were able to build an entire ecosystem around technology. Gordon Moore, in a different context, told me that one of the great ways to make sure you have a good part of the market is to shoot your arrow and then draw the bullseye around the arrow. And that's sort of what happened in the valley. The technology landed here, and then the business environment grew up around the technology, kind of perfectly developed for it. And a third thing was that the culture out here was remarkably open. Back in the 50s and 60s, there was this huge influx of people to Silicon Valley, And of course, that influx continues today with people from all over the world. And by the time you get to the book that I wrote, which is about the 1970s, you have that kind of openness becoming the counterculture and the hippie movement. And so you ended up with a very, very powerful technology in the hands of free thinkers. And that is what really kicked things off.
Well, there's one author that I'm keeping to myself because I love him. We talked to Andy Weir when The Martian came out. We talked to him about Matt Damon playing the role. And he's written a new novel, which I loved, about the moon, a moon colony called Artemis. We'll wrap things up with one of my favorite interviews of the year, The Martian's Andy Weir. First of all, I should talk about a little bit about Artemis. We're not on Mars. We're on the moon. There is lots of science in here. I think one of the things, if people read both books, they'll say, oh, we know a little bit about Andy Weir. He loves science. And he loves the idea of solving problems with science, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, problem solving and science faction.
Science faction. I like it.
I didn't come up with that, but I've seen it.
It's hard science sci-fi. And this is much more of a sci-fi book. So I guess what I was starting to say is that The Martian is really, it's science fiction in the sense that there's a guy on Mars, and we aren't yet on Mars, but it's kind of very credible, believable,
yeah,
NASA-type stuff. I mean, it's not way out there with ray guns or anything.
Right. And, well, believe it or not, Artemis is actually more true to real science than The Martian is. But it takes place further in the future. Martian takes place in the 2030s. Artemis takes place in the 2090s. It's actually, you could argue, it's a little silly, but you could argue that it's economic fiction.
It is. But if you say that, people aren't going to read it. So
people aren't going to read it.
Don't say that.
No, but the only, I'll say it this way. The main conceit of Artemis, the main suspension of disbelief necessary in terms of the science, is that the price to low Earth orbit has been driven down a lot by competition in the, commercial space industry.
I think we're seeing that happen right now, right?
Yeah. And I did a whole thing. I actually wrote a paper on it it's not a paper you, as in peer reviewed thing, but I wrote an essay on why I think how low I think commercial space travel will be driven down, the price to low Earth orbit will be driven down by commercial competition, and those numbers are what I based Artemis's economy on.
Yeah, and so one of the idea, and there will be no spoilers on this. All of this you can figure out if you just look at the cover, probably. Although it looks a little bit like an eclipse, I think the timing is very.
Yeah, that was cool. Well, actually, I'd suggested to Random House, hey, can we release on August 21st?
Yeah,
And then we'd be releasing this book about the moon during the eclipse and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, that'd be cool, but no.
It's a fall release, because that's when you should be honored. That's when the big books come out.
Okay.
Right.
Okay,
good. That's when the big books come out. This is going to be the Christmas, buying season.
I'll be on shelves for the Christmas season.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed, but I did, this walk down memory lane and some of the best interviews. It's really only a tip of the iceberg. We had 52 great shows and 52 great interviews. If you haven't seen all the Triangulation episodes from 2017, there's still time to go back and catch up. But get ready, because there's a whole new year ahead and lots of really interesting interviews with some of the best minds in technology. I hope you will join us for those. I hope you have a wonderful, happy new year. Let's hope for peace and prosperity for all of us in 2018. We'll see you right back here at Triangulation. I'm Leo Laporte. Happy New Year!